rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Borey, Judge Smith. The Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and take a seat, everyone. We have an ITV hearing that's presently scheduled. We do also have individuals that are here in the courtroom at the Minnesota Judicial Center. I want to make sure we have everyone on just so that we can begin our proceeding. Appellate attorney, you're arguing from Cass County. Can you hear me?
I can, Judge.
And respondent attorney, you're next door in the Centennial Building. Can you also hear me?
Yes, I can.
That means we're ready to go. I'll ask our marshal to call the case for consideration.
Second case on today's calendar is A191640, Henry, the estate of Deanna Marie Hoyer, deceased.
And appellate counsel, when you're ready to proceed, if you'll approach the podium at the place that you're speaking from, indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of for record purposes. You'll have 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal if you choose to use that. When you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Larry Kimball appearing on behalf of appellate Jeffrey Z., speaking from Cass County. I am asking this court to remand this matter for a hearing on the probate motion that I filed on June 18th of 2018. I am asking in the alternative that the court remand the matter for factual findings by the trial judge, Judge Melby, in Beltrami County.
If it's a de novo review, Mr. Kimball, if it's a de novo review on the second issue you just raised, why would we need to remand that when the court can look at the record itself?
Thank you, Judge. It is a de novo review. However, I believe that there are issues of a factual nature that have been presented and not presented due to the procedure that the trial court followed. Now, while the court certainly reviews those facts de novo, I do think that there are factual issues that would be beneficial in deciding the case.
What are those facts? Because based on what the oral order was on the record, there was some indication that the matter had been decided before. So how is this different than the facts that were presented to the trial court?
Thank you, Judge Smith. There are two parts of Judge Melby's order. One was statute of limitations, and the other was res judicata. I think the statute of limitations issue was decided in Judge Cleary's order finding jurisdiction with this court. That order came out December of last year. The other matter is res judicata. As I said in my response, there has not been a finding. There has never been a hearing on the merits in this matter.
There's been two judgments, final judgments entered, though, and there's been an appeal from the second final judgment that was dismissed as untimely. It seems to me there's been significant opportunity to litigate the matter, but they've been dismissed. And there's a number of cases that recognize that dismissals short of an actual evidentiary hearing still can be addressed through res judicata. How do we get around that?
Thank you, Judge. The court is quite right. There are two prior orders addressing facts at least similar, not identical. However, I'll say this ahead of time. As I read the cases on res judicata, it is not a matter of simply applying the law, that there is discretion and the court is to make the decision on res judicata only after careful consideration. And I'm referring to Brown v. Felsen, It is not simply a mathematical application, but the court is directed to look at the merits and make sure the parties have a fair opportunity for a hearing. That did not occur in this case, a fair opportunity for a hearing.
But isn't that the type of case that we would review to determine in the first instance if it has been properly reviewed?
There certainly is an appeal option. However, in each of those cases, Judge Melby's order, in addition to stating that the matter was being dismissed, offered the alternative. In the first case, he said in the order, by agreement of the parties, either in probate court or small claims court. He then makes the finding of dismissing it with prejudice. I believe those are inconsistent, and I think that's a procedural barrier that is mentioned in all of the res judicata analysis, that both on the first case was saying, yeah, I'm dismissing this one, but you can bring it here or here. And then the second time saying, yes, I'm dismissing this one, but I'm giving you till the end of the week to file a motion in probate court, which I did. So on each of those occasions, Judge Melby did allow an opportunity for a further hearing, although he did say it's dismissed with prejudice on both of those orders. However, I get into the analysis of whether a dismissal on res judicata was appropriate or not. Judge Flory mentioned the second appeal. That was dismissed for improper filing, untimely filing, and that's true. However, I don't think that that dismissal changes the analysis that I'm providing. First of all, that there was never an opportunity for a hearing. These matters were dismissed summarily. This last matter, the motion, was dismissed summarily with no record as to what the court was referring to or not referring to. So I think that in that sense, the record is incomplete.
Let me get back to that. If there's a dismissal with prejudice, even if it was an error and it wasn't appealed, how do we get around the dismissal with prejudice issue?
Because the trial court specifically on both occasions allowed a further filing, and in fact invited that.
But was that in the order?
The first time it was in the order. The second time it was in what the court stated on the record at the time.
But the order was a dismissal with prejudice, and I'm trying to ascertain how we get around that dismissal with prejudice.
It's two ways. One way is in getting around it, you say why res judicata shouldn't apply. I think this is one of those unique circumstances where the merits are better served by proceeding with the hearing, not with following what appears to be a pretty direct statement in the order. And the other is just the procedural ambiguity, I think, presents an unfair obstacle. We were directed by the court on how to proceed. Now, the court on both of those occasions did not issue its order the way it came out at the time. In other words, did not say it's dismissed with prejudice. The court, in fact, offered the alternative. So I think reading simply the words dismissed with prejudice are not what was going on with those orders. So I think that's how that issue is addressed.
It's 7 minutes. We've lost. If you'll call and try to get this reconvened.
You might want to stop the timer. He just stopped.
Yeah, just cut out.
Sherry's gonna call me.
What's minutes?
What's that?
Is she calling minute?
Yep, yep, she's calling Gary right now, so I'll see what she says.
Well, we'll just hang tight.
It will appear in this fashion. This case commenced on February 21st, 2015, about 5 years ago to the day. Zachary Z. Warrior, age 10, came home, found his mother had committed suicide. That set the chain of events leading up to now. At the time, Jeffrey Z. and Ms. Hoyer were separated. Ms. Hoyer's sister, Janet Hoyer, stepped in and did commence a probate and a conservatorship. The probate had real property and personal property. It is our position that the assets of the estate were fraudulently misapplied, that virtually nothing went to Zachary, and there's been no accounting. Some of the issues, you know, the closing of the estate had not occurred when the first action was filed. The first action dealt primarily with Jeffrey Z's items. So in terms of res judicata, this is a different case. There are different facts. At the time of the second hearing, that involved some trust issues that are tangentially related, and that involves issues that was just prior to when the application to close the estate was filed. So I do think that there the facts have developed in such a fashion that this probate action is appropriate. It is not issue preclusion. It is not claim preclusion, because the issues and the claims will be based on items not present previously, basically the closing of the estate. The statement by the personal representative, I have done everything. Up until that time, there was a question as to just what was going to be done. There has been difficulties getting the facts about the case out, and there have been difficulties all along with knowing what became of the items. I think this is a case on the merits that is very important and significant, and that supports an opportunity for a hearing based on those allegations. I do think that the, as I read the cases on res judicata, there is either an element of the matter having been tried or addressed exhaustively, or it appearing clearly that the underlying merits, that there was no merit to the underlying claims. This case before the court now has neither of those aspects. I do think that enters into this court's consideration. I think the case law directs the court to look at fundamental justice. So I am asking that, based on fundamental justice, based on the ambiguity of the underlying court's opinion, and finally based on what I call a lack of an opinion, there was a written opinion filed, but it addressed none of our issues. I appreciate a de novo review, but I think that there are factual elements that really need to be filled out before this court could provide adequate review. Based on those, I am asking that this court either remand for a hearing on the merits or remand for a further order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. We'll turn now to respondent counsel.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court, my name is John
Lawrence Bethenhagen. I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, Janet Boyer. The district court should be affirmed because it correctly held, first, that these claims are barred by the doctrine of res judicata. Second, that the claims are independently barred by the statute of limitations of the probate code, Minnesota Statute 524.3.1005. I'll address those in turn. First, the application of res judicata was straightforward and correctly applied by the district court. There are four requirements for res judicata. Each of those requirements has been met four square, clearly and unambiguously in this case. Point one, is it the same set of facts? It is without question the same set of facts.
You know, Mr. Stephenhagen, Mr. Kimball just said regarding the second district court action that the facts aren't the same, that the second district court action dealt with trust issues and not with the property involved here. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely disagree with that. And I think a review of the second district court action will prove to a certainty that the same allegations of theft were at issue in the second district court action. Of that, we are confident. We are confident, too, that if that had been the case, Appellant would have raised that in his opening brief. Appellant would have said that there was some difference between the facts. There is no allegation to that effect in the opening brief nor in the reply brief. So what we're hearing today for the first time on oral argument is that the facts are different. The facts are precisely the same. There is no merit to that argument. The same facts were addressed in two district court actions, a conciliation court complaint, a probate matter the first time, and a conservatorship matter. So before we arrive before the district court for the second time in the probate matter, they had five opportunities and took them to raise precisely the same issues. Point number one, the facts are the same. A counsel's argument for the first time this morning is unavailable, and counsel did not preserve that argument before the district court either, as the record will very clearly confirm. Point two of res judicata. The parties are precisely the same. There is no allegation in that regard from the appellant. Point three, as Your Honor noted, there have been two final judgments on the merit, both with prejudice. The first was not appealed. The second was appealed. But as counsel told the district court, he blew the appeal, at his words. Therefore, it was reduced to a final judgment that could not be appealed. Now, we've heard today that the district court was somehow granting direction to appellant about how to proceed and where to bring the claim. That is incorrect. As the district court noted in page 12 of the transcript, in this manner, when Mr. Kimball made the same argument about the district court directing his client to file here or there, the court said, I just want to stop you. This is page 12. Any direction this court gave you is not giving validity to any claim. So they made the same argument before the district court, and that was shut down. The district court did not give direction about how to proceed. Appellant chose that path on their own. Point four, a full and fair opportunity to litigate. It would scarcely be the case that I could find an instance in which an appellant has had more of an opportunity and utilized it to the fullest over the span of 4 years in six duplicative legal proceedings. Now, appellant's claim today, apparently, is that this court, in the interest of justice, should somehow modify or shape the rules of res judicata that have been in place in this state for decades. There is no such discretion that should be applied in this case. They cite two cases. Both of those cases were completely inapposite to this case regarding discretion to somehow circumvent the four requirements of res judicata. In the first case, the court was dealing with a one-of situation in which an appeal inured to the benefit of a non-appealing party. That's not the case. the subsequent case. That's not the point here either. The point we have here is that this party, appellant, has made precisely the same arguments for years. Now, appellant's argument, apparently, is that it requires a full hearing, or it requires an evidentiary hearing, or a trial. Neither is that the law. The law is clear, as Your Honor noted, that summary dismissals, whether it be a Rule 56 or be a Rule 12, are entitled to res judicata effect.
Let me ask this about the district court order. It seems a little skimpy or incomplete because it doesn't really tell us what the court was relying on as far as facts to determine the res judicata. Can you address that, please?
I can't. All of these cases were assigned to a single judge, Judge Melby, John Melby. Over the span of 4 years, Judge Melby had the opportunity to observe this case intimately as it evolved from one forum to another, always with the same facts. So it would be expected that Judge Melby would not have to explain things to a party represented by Mr. Kimball, who had brought those same claims himself. The court did that the claims had snowballed. The court was exceptionally aware that this case had bounced from one proceeding to another. And in the district court's word, it is all the same claim. Now, we black quote the judge's holding in our brief. The district court was acutely aware that it was the same claim, correctly noted that it had gone from one proceeding to another, and correctly noted that the claim had, in the words of the district court, snowballed. It started as a $10,000 case, and by the time Mr. Kimball and I stood up in district court, it had turned into a $50,000 case over precisely the same allegations of theft. So, appellant's criticism of the district court's lack of a written order, we do not believe is well taken. This district court judge was intimately familiar with every aspect of every one of these prior proceedings, knew it full well, called appellant's counsel short when he made the argument that the district court directed him to bring actions in a duplicative manner, and very succinctly, I think, and professionally, noted that this is precisely the same claim that's gone on again and again. Your Honors, if you don't have anything further on the doctrine of res judicata, I'll turn to the issue of the statute of limitations. In that regard, as an alternative basis to affirm the district court's decision, this claim is too barred by the statute of limitations in the probate code. The statement to close the probate matter was filed in September 2017. Over 9 months later, appellant and his attorney reappeared in the probate matter. That is barred by the six-month statute of limitations. Now, they make no argument whatsoever in their opening brief regarding the statute of limitations. It is questionable whether they even preserved the argument before the district court. At a minimum, however, the fact that they didn't even raise it on appeal is yet an alternative basis to confirm, affirm the holding of the district court. Your Honor, I think the facts are clear. I think the law is exceptionally clear. I understand that I have 5 minutes remaining. I think I have said what needed to be said both today and in our brief. If you have anything further, I'd be happy to answer it.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Steffenhagen. We'll turn back now to you, Mr. Kimball, if you have any rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to address a few of the things that he said. The characterization that the Judge Melby had an intimate knowledge of the facts, I think, is incorrect. There was a rather summary probate proceeding on a filing. There was no litigation on that. the conservatorship, there was no litigation on that. We reached an agreement. It was set for a hearing, but we reached an agreement, Mr. Stefan Hagen and I, and resolved that. So there's really only four cases that have occurred. There's the probate, which is the one we're on now. There is the conservatorship, which is ongoing, but is a different kind of action, and there's never been litigation in that. There was the first civil action, which was commenced early on before the probate had been administered and before the filing of the closing statement. So issues occurred since then, and the court's order clearly left the back door open on that one. That leaves the second civil case, the same thing there. Certainly I wish the appeal would have gone through. However, the court in that case as well did leave a back door open. I think given the ambiguity that the court addressed this with, is cause enough to allow the hearing to go forward. There just hasn't been much done on these facts. There have been motions made and the information has been put before the court, but never in a way to determine an answer. Really, this is one where the court issued at the very start, the actions had been filed, but there was no response made, never an answer. The issues were not even joined. Dismissal based on reasons that were not elaborated in any depth. There's always the res judicata claim, or I've heard this to death. It simply did not happen. There was never a recognition by the court that it was being treated as summary judgment and proceeding in that fashion. There was never a finding that the pleadings as set forth did not support a claim. So I think the characterization that the judge was very familiar with the case and decided it had no merit is just not accurate. I think the judge perhaps felt that he'd seen it a lot, but that's different than making a decision on it. Turning a bit to the statute of limitations, again, I think Judge Cleary's order settles that. But in addition to what he found, that is that the order was not served out, so the six-month period did not yet run, the statute clearly exempts a fraud case from the six-month period of time. So I think on either theory, the case is still, this court still has jurisdiction. I want to mention something following Judge Flory's question. The second civil case had different issues in addition to what I would say the claims against Ms. Hoyer. So it was not a completely different case, but it did have different issues. I just wanted that clarification. So with that, I have nothing further at this time. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing and presenting your case via ITV today. Matters are deemed submitted. A decision will be issued within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you. Court is now adjourned.
All rise.